I'm discussing a topic today that's not biblical. Mark asked me to speak on the subject of the lost tomb of the lost tomb of Jesus controversy that you may have heard in the news. And just a word about these slides. I should have adjusted this first slide, but this is more like 12 refutations as opposed to 12 myths. But let me set the table for this thing. How many of you have heard of the so-called tomb of Jesus, which they've discovered, quote unquote? Okay, almost everybody. A few weeks ago, it was made known that this special was going to air on the Discovery Network. And they had a press conference in New York. And actually, I got a call that first night from a news organization that said, this is Sunday afternoon. They called me and they said, can you get on a plane and be in New York by tonight? And I said, you don't know what town I live in. It takes 2 days to get anywhere. He said, well, we really need you there at 10 o'clock the next morning. I said, well, good luck. And he tried to get a few people, Ben Witherington, Daryl Bach, and myself. And this thing was breaking the next morning at an unknown location in New York. So he said, literally, he said, can you fly to New York tonight? And by tomorrow morning, we'll know where this thing is happening. We'll get the advanced on it, and we'll get you in a taxi, and we'll take you there. But right now, we didn't even know where the news conference is because they were keeping it quiet. And when the conference did break the next day, and then, of course, the Discovery Channel documentary came the next Sunday night, here's what we heard. We heard that a tomb has been discovered in East Talpiot, which is a section of Jerusalem. It's about 3 miles removed from one of the classic places where one of the candidates for Calvary, where Jesus was crucified. And this tomb is about 3 miles from there, and underneath an apartment building, as often happens in the Middle East, they dusted away and moved some rocks and found this really ornate opening to a tomb. Now, in Israel in the first century, there were two well-known sorts of tombs. One around the Jerusalem area, that it was almost always the Jerusalem area, and you had to be pretty wealthy to have this kind of a tomb. They would use a cave, or more likely, they would cut the tomb out of bedrock, hence its expensive nature. And inside that tomb, it's 5 or 6 feet tall when you go down the steps and you walk into the tomb. And around the edges, there would be shafts called loculi, and these would be a couple feet wide and 5 to 6 feet deep, and they would take a deceased body. The Jews had 24 hours to bury a person, and they would take the body and wash it and clothe it in linen and slide it in one of those loculi, and these were family tombs. More about that in a few moments. And after about a year or so, they'd go back in, and all that would be left would be bones. And they'd take the bones, and they would bury them in so-called bone boxes, or ossuaries. And the ossuaries were about 18 to 21 inches long, basically long enough to get the femur, leg bone, in there, as long as bone. And sometimes they would cram multiple, I mean as in a half dozen skeletons in one ossuary. And a quarter of the time they would put the person's name on the outside, they would scratch it into the rock, put the lid on it, lay it aside in the tomb, and you'd have a loculi all clean and ready for the next person who died. Now, a word about these tombs, because this is very, very crucial to the discussion and very, very few people bring it up. Just remember longitude and latitude. First of all, these tombs are for extended families. It's not just for 5, 6, 7 people under one roof. It's extended families, so it's for grandparents, uncles, cousins, spouses, children. And in that society, very, very different from our society, a lot of people would die very young. And you might marry a second time or a third time, and those people would be widows or widowers, and they'd have their children. And those folks would be brought into the extended family, and sometimes you might have a servant, a loved servant who has nowhere to be buried, and they would be placed in here. But it's not just under one household. One of the leading researchers said that he had a family tomb with 14 ossuaries and 88 skeletons. Now this is a true extended family. So extended family this way. Then the other direction, these lasted for 3 to 5 generations. The period of ossuaries is about 100 years, give or take, in Jerusalem. And it's give or take because there was no absolute starting and no absolute ending period. It pretty much ended with the Jewish-Roman War, 66 to 70 AD, but there's even some examples of ossuaries that go 50 years after that. But for the most part, 100 years, extended families. And in this Talpiot tomb, for example, the original report said that there were 35 individuals buried in this tomb. So when you say, we found the Jesus family, first of all, you just have to understand what they mean by family and extend it in both directions. Okay, and the next, there were 10 ossuaries in our bone boxes in this tomb. One ended up missing, so now there's 9. And of those 9, 6 have names on them. And as I said, even that's odd because only 25% of the ossuaries have names scratched to the outside. Here's the names in this tomb. Matthew, Maria, Mary, Mariamne, another form of Mary, Yossi, which is a nickname for Joseph, and then these two interesting ossuaries. Jesus, son of Joseph, and Judah, son of Jesus. And of course, the news conference said, and they didn't so much declare as they asked leading questions. Could this be the tomb of Jesus? This is exciting. Now, they start out trying to make you think we are doing Christendom a favor. They start out saying, many scholars believe Jesus never lived. Let me tell you, it's appropriate that two movie producers were the main figures in this. Virtually no scholars today believe Jesus. I mean, you can literally name the scholars on one hand. And those who do are just dismissed by everybody else. So here's what their claim was. We don't even know if Jesus existed. But just think about it. We've uncovered the first physical evidence that Jesus lived. Yeah, his bones. Oh, well, forget about that. You can still, as I said, you can still believe in a spiritual resurrection. Be excited. We've got some evidence here. So that was the early claim. Jesus, son of Joseph, and Judah, son of Jesus. Since then, there's been a withering blast of criticism from scholars. And you say, well, yeah, conservatives. But guess what? Very few conservatives have gotten involved in the debate. It's mostly moderates, those you'd call liberals, skeptics, and Jewish archaeologists and scholars. And not a single person has been convinced by this data, except one scholar they had on board from the beginning. His name is James Tabor. He's the University of North Carolina, Charlotte. He's the department head of the School of Religion. He's a very nice guy. I was with him a year ago. He wrote me an email in the middle of nowhere. I did a television program, and I was critiquing his views, and he wrote me an email, and he said, thanks for being fair. He said, most evangelicals are not fair. He said, thanks for being fair. And it turned out I was in Charlotte a little bit after that, and I spent an afternoon with James Tabor, and he told me all this was coming a year ahead of time. I said, well, how am I going to know when I hear about all this DNA stuff? He said, watch the television. Well, sure enough, it broke this year. But interestingly, the scholars that have gone after this, as I said, the majority of them are not evangelicals, and they've just... I mean, they've won no one. And just this week, there's an article that almost everybody who made any kind of a comment that was anything other than negative, they've all backed off this week. And I'll tell you what the latest data are that have caused people to do that. Well, let's go ahead and talk about some of this. Sometimes Christians get a little bothered when they hear, Jesus, son of Joseph. Wow. I mean, that is the Jesus in the Gospels, right? Okay, let's talk about this for a second. Joseph is the second most common male name in ancient Israel. The only more common name is Simon or Simeon. That's the only more common name. And Jesus is one of the most common names. We have a lot of information about names in first century Israel, both from ossuaries and from other name lists. And it depends exactly which list you use, but about 1 in 10 or 1 in 15 men were named Jesus. Very common name. In fact, on ossuaries, there are 45 ossuaries in existence, stone burial boxes, bone boxes, so to speak. 45 ossuaries with the name Joseph on them, and 22 ossuaries with the name Jesus on them. And say, yeah, but this ossuary says Jesus, son of Joseph. How many Jesus, son of Josephs were there in Jerusalem? Well, let's talk a few statistics. Over the length of the period of ossuaries, about 100 years, it's estimated that there were 80,000 males in Jerusalem during that period of 100 years. This figure is even used in the Jacob V.C. Pellegrino, the book that came out favoring, arguing that this is the tomb of Jesus. They use the same figure, and that's significant. 80,000 males in Jerusalem during the age of the ossuaries. Guess how many, if you said, how many are Jesuses? 1 in 10 or 1 in 15? How many of these Jesuses would have Josephs for a father? Now, when people first hear the ossuary, they're thinking, oh, wow, Jesus, son of Joseph. Is that a problem? Well, in Jerusalem, only over the age of the ossuaries, and only Jerusalem. How about if you're from anywhere else in Israel? There were, according to the statistics we have, over 1,000 men named Jesus whose father was named Joseph. So before you even start, it's 1,000-to-1 shot that this is Jesus' tomb. And that's just if you concede a number of things. So these names are very, very common. Secondly, Mary is the most common female name, and there are two Marys in the tomb. Most common female name. How common? 1 in 4 women was named Mary. 1 in 4. And if you use derivatives of the name for Mary, almost 1 in 2, almost half of all the women were named Mary. The range of Jewish names is nowhere near as broad as the range of names in our society. In fact, of all the names they have, in all the ossuaries and from all the other name lists, the vast majority of them number just 16. 16 total names account for about 80% of the population. And 1/4 to 1/2 of the women are called Mary. And there are two Marys in the tomb. All right, we'll see that it's even worse than this. I mean, there are just a lot of Marys and a lot of Josephs and a lot of Jesus. But when the research first came out, people said, well, look, this is not a new tomb. No, it's not. The tomb was discovered in 1980. And a British documentary was done in 1996. And they knew what they were doing. The British documentary and the BBC asked the question, is this the burial tomb of Jesus? And nobody gave it the time of day. No splash, no news. But this time, when the Discovery Channel Network did it, one of the movie producers said this, well, yeah, nobody paid attention to this tomb because no one paid attention to the BBC documentary because they didn't have the DNA. We've got DNA. Now, you know, in this generation, I'm not a fan of any of the CSI type programs, but you know, today, someone just told me this week, if you don't have DNA in a crime, people are under the impression these days, you've got nothing. If you've got DNA, you got everything. You don't have DNA, you've got nothing. They've got the DNA. Oh, really? Okay. What's the DNA show? Well, there were 10 ossuaries, 6 with names. But whenever Jews discover ossuaries, they believe in the resurrection of the body. And whenever they uncover an ossuary, they immediately rebury the bones. They immediately rebury the bones. So they have 10 ossuaries, and the vast 8 of the 10 had been, in their words, vacuumed. They'd been cleaned. Two of the ossuaries had debris. You don't need a lot to DNA. And two of the ossuaries had material that could be tested. Those two ossuaries, Jesus, son of Joseph, and Mariamne, one of the Marys. That Mariamne, by the way, the name it's an enigma, but we'll get to it in a further slide here. But they're the only two. And guess what the results were? They could only do mitochondrial DNA. They can't do nuclear DNA, so they can't do a DNA fingerprint. They can only tell if they're common mothers. Conclusion, no match. So all this hullabaloo about we've got the DNA showed nothing. Now at first, you know, never let a good story die. At first, when they had no DNA match, here's how the popularizers were quoted. Well, if they're not related by their mothers, well, then they're married. Well, whenever I see two people who are not related, I always know they're married, you know? This is my first conclusion, right? First thing is they forget that tombs are longitudinal and latitudinal. The two Marys in the tomb could both have been uncles' wives from 50 years earlier. The Jesus buried in the Talpiot tomb may never have known these two women. In fact, from the names in the ossuaries, we only know that there are immediate family connections between three of them. Joseph, Jesus, and Judah. And that's only if we can read the name Jesus. There's a lot of dispute about this now. The name Jesus is the most, it's the scribbled, it's all messed up. There are lines going through it, and people think it's other names, and of course, if there's no Jesus, there's no story. But it may not be Jesus. Secondly, there could be more than one Jesus in the tomb. Just like there's two Marys in the tomb. There could be more than one Jesus. But if we concede that there's only one Jesus, and that this is Jesus, and that Jesus is buried in Jerusalem and not in some other town, even if you concede all that, the problem is that these are cousins, second and third spouses, children from other marriages, beloved servants. There's no way to do a connection between them. So at first, the expert who did the DNA test said, or was reported to have said, they must be married. But now he's totally backed off, and here's what he's saying. There's no DNA connection between them. That means there's no known connection at all. He says, after all, we have no test for marriage. So the DNA, now we have DNA, turns out to be absolutely nothing. Nothing like a good story, though, right? This is the one that got everybody's attention that has been totally destroyed. When the commentators first came out, they said, we hired a statistician, professor of statistics, University of Toronto, and they did two rounds of statistics. One asked the question, what's the likelihood that these six people would be together? Second question, how close are these six people to the family of Jesus? And they worked through the statistics, and they said there's a 600-to-1 chance that this is Jesus' tomb. First of all, to get any six people together in our society, especially if some of them have nicknames, Yossi is a nickname, Mariamne is a nickname. If you had folks over to your house, six people to your house last night, they could all be common names, men and women. They could all be common names. But especially if two of them are nicknames, and one of those nicknames is very rare. This is the only Mariamne that's known on a tomb. So if you have a friend with a really odd nickname, and another person, Yossi, with a fairly common nickname, and a couple people who are known by their father's names, son of, and that's where they go by, if you had six people like that at your house last night, no matter how common the names are, the odds would be very great that those six people should not all be together last night. So that doesn't mean anything. The only connection is, could this be Jesus' family? And I've already said, all you have are three connections. These are the only three known connections. Joseph, Jesus, Judah. Now here's how statistics work. If Jesus is the son of Joseph, this Jesus in the tomb, and there are 1,000 males in Jerusalem who are Jesus's, who are son of Joseph's, then it's 1,000-to-1 shot that you've got the right Jesus. The only other question you know from the tomb is, does this Jesus have a son named Judah? Apparently. But how about Jesus' family? Does Jesus' family have a son? No. Was Jesus married? No. Da Vinci Code notwithstanding, there's not one... I'm going to be running ahead of some of my critiques when I get... share some of them now. We'll just pop them up later. But there's not one source in the ancient world, not one, that says Jesus was married to anybody. Now, I want to be clear. This is just my opinion. I don't think there's any crime if Jesus was married. I don't think there's any crime if Jesus had children. If he did, we'd hold him up as the ideal husband and the ideal father. That's what we do. It's not a crime. The problem is not, in my opinion, that Jesus couldn't, you know, there's no way he could be married. The problem is, this is revisionist history. The problem is we're Monday morning quarterbacking. The problem is we're writing the script after the game was already over. And there's no historical evidence. So if you ask the question, did Jesus of Nazareth have a son? The odds are strongly against it on historical data. Now what do you think the odds are? I think if you said 20%, you'd be pretty high. They've done some surveys. A lot of people have put that number at zero. But if you said there's a 20% chance he had a son, here's what you do. There are 5 20s in 100. So you'd multiply the 1,000-to-1 men times 5 that he would have a father named Joseph and a son named Judah. And right away, it's a 5,000-to-1 shot. But recently, the statistician from University of Toronto was countered by a number of other statisticians, one from Ohio State University, one, this guy's interesting, you can go to his website, Randy Ingermanson, he calls himself the deranged physicist, on his website. The guy's got a PhD in theoretical physics from Cal Berkeley, and he's a mathematician, and he's done a spreadsheet. And philosophers, political scientists, a lot of the sciences, they use a very well-known mathematical calculus called Bayes' theorem. And it's a very well-tested device for predicting what the likelihood of a theory is as you get more evidence. You crank new theses into it. And Randy Ingermanson made a spreadsheet for Bayes' theorem with everything we know about the Talpiot tomb is worked into it. And there are a few fuzzy questions. You have to answer a few questions. For example, how many Josephs are in the tomb? Did this Jesus have a child? You answer the questions right on the spreadsheet. It's a lot of fun. You can play around with it. And there's 5 questions to ask. And every time you answer the question, you hit enter. And it'll hop down to the next one. And there's a graph over on the right. And this whole Bayes' theorem works out for you. And as you hit enter, I'm not very good with the computer, but this thing's really neat to watch. Every time you hit enter, the graph changes. And then you go over and you see what are your odds. And you can be liberal one minute, the next minute you can be conservative, and you can do your odds. Here's what Randy Ingermanson has contributed to this debate. You cannot answer the relevant questions to make this Jesus of Nazareth's tomb. It doesn't make any difference how far to the left or how far to the right you want to go. You cannot skew the data to make this anywhere near likely that this is Jesus' tomb. In fact, the odds are usually something like 5,000,000-to-1 against. But you can do the math. And since he's come out with his latest Bayes' theorem spreadsheet, everybody who is even hanging on slightly has dropped off the map. And the people who are saying positive things have said, instead of saying it is Jesus' tomb, now they're saying, well, it could be, couldn't it? We at least have to be open. They've totally changed their tomb, but the stats have gone against it seriously. Like I said, with only those three names and a 20% likelihood that he has a son, the chances are 5,000 to 1 on that alone. All right, here's some more problems. As I just said, there's no historical or tomb connection to Mary Magdalene. There's no reason to think that Mary Magdalene should be in that tomb. But that doesn't stop the two film producers. They say Mariamne is Mary Magdalene, Shades of Da Vinci. No historical sources for this. Ah, but they found one. Really? Okay. They found a 4th century A.D. document that called some lady Mariamne. You can't tell who she is by reading the document. Could be Mary Magdalene, could be Mary of Martha fame of the village of Bethany. It's hard, you can't tell who the woman is. But they take the name, watch all the problems. They take a name from the 4th century A.D. You don't know who she is, but let's make her Mary Magdalene. And let's Monday morning quarterback her back into Jesus' tomb and say Jesus married her. Oh, and by the way, the DNA doesn't help. The DNA doesn't do anything. Of course, it wouldn't expect that if they were married. But they just stick her in there. There's no reason for this at all. And the 4th century document is way too late to make any difference whatsoever. But, you know, anything that makes a good story, go ahead and talk about it. That's what they're doing. Okay. Likewise, no historical evidence that Jesus was married to anybody or that he had any children. Twice in the Gospels, Jesus is called something like son of Joseph. One is in a genealogy in the book of Luke, and once is by a person who just met Jesus. But no followers, no disciples, no family members call Jesus the son of Joseph. And yet that's what this ossuary says. These are smaller problems, except for the last one, or last two. It's highly unlikely that the Jesus family tomb would be in Jerusalem. You say, well, Joseph buried him there, but that's not the point I'm making. I'm saying if there's a Jesus family tomb, it makes sense that it would be in Nazareth or even Bethlehem, but not in Jerusalem. The tapia tomb apparently belonged to a wealthy family. Again, this is in boxing terms, this is a punch, but it's not a knockout punch. After all, to be honest, Joseph buried Jesus once. Somebody who was wealthy could have reburied his bones. I mean, that's, I'm not saying that happened. I'm just saying this critique doesn't explain a lot, but it's helpful. The critics on the Discovery Channel program say that the missing ossuary, there's a 10th ossuary that later disappeared. They claim it's another famous ossuary you may have seen in the news a couple years ago, James, the brother of Jesus. But this ossuary says James, the son of Joseph, brother of Jesus. And they're saying, ah, now that would tighten the family thing up even more. Several suggestions, though. James, the son of Joseph, the brother of Jesus. First of all, this ossuary is of known measurements. In fact, I've seen it. I was in Toronto a few years ago, and it was at the museum downtown. So several of us took a cab and went downtown and saw the James ossuary. It's of known dimensions, and even though the 10th ossuary from the Telpia tomb was lost, its dimensions are known, and the dimensions are off by a good percentage. There are 20% difference in the measurements. The two ossuaries are different ossuaries. Lastly, the 10th ossuary from the Telpia tomb had no name on it. It was plain. And what they do with plain ossuaries, the reason it's missing, they throw it into a common area at the Metropolitan Museum in Jerusalem. They just put all the ossuaries. You can buy ossuaries in marketplaces in Jerusalem. And they sell you the ones that aren't, you know, necessarily so good looking or don't have names on them or things like that. That's why the 10th one's missing. But the measurements are different than James, and here's the real breaker. The man, Oded Galan, who owns the James ossuary, is now on trial because they think he faked this thing and they think he stole it and so on. But he has a photograph of the James ossuary from 1976. The date's right on. It's been tested in an FBI lab. It's as nearly as they can tell. It's a good photograph from 1976, but this tomb was not discovered until 1980. So even now, Jacob Vesey, the main filmmaker who's behind this, he says if the James ossuary is photographed in 1976, it's not our ossuary. So this one is a dead issue now, too. The last two are a little more important. You know, I was ready to say this to you today, and then Brian mentioned it in the reading this morning, but if last week, you know, we know we're about the right time of the year for Easter. You know, it changes the calendar. But if last week were the date for the original Easter, this would be the date for the appearance to Thomas. So we're right in the time of the appearances. And all our early sources say that Jesus' tomb was empty within 3 days. All our early sources, and they're not just Christian sources, but there's not a single source within 150, 200 years, actually a lot more than that, but after that, who cares? I mean, history doesn't, you know, these sources are not helpful after about 150 years in the ancient world. But there are no sources that dispute the empty tomb. And if the tomb is empty, what you have to do is bury Jesus on Friday, or whatever day you think it is. The Gospels don't have a day. But the traditional view is that he was buried on Friday. And you'd have to bury him on Friday, unbury him on Saturday, take his body somewhere else, and then bury the bones a year later. It's a very complicated view. Why would you bury him on Friday and undo the job just a day later? There's obviously no evidence for that. But the sources tell us that Jesus' tomb is empty. The one that really, really hurts the Talpiot thesis is this one. The Talpiot folks say, well, look, if we've got the body of Jesus, this isn't against you Christians. You guys can still believe in a spiritual resurrection. But if you're thinking through this, you know that the New Testament doesn't teach a spiritual resurrection. The New Testament teaches a bodily resurrection. And there's a lot of arguments for this. In fact, a book came out in 2003, a 750-page book on the resurrection of Jesus by N.T. Wright. He spends 500 pages, and this is overkill, 500 pages showing you that the early Jewish view of resurrection was resurrection of the body. In fact, it's such a strong argument that the two major Greek terms that argue for resurrection, the two words are anastasis and agero. That's raised, and anastasis is the main one. That's the term that's used in 1 Corinthians 15:8. And agero for being raised up from the dead. And the terms, no matter whether they're used by unbelievers, Jews or Christians, pagans, Jews, Christians, nobody, this is N.T. Wright's argument, nobody used that word in anything else than a bodily sense up until 200 A.D., until the Gnostics got on the scene. But from all the way back, hundreds of years B.C., you can say, well, that can't be right, because the Greeks believed in spiritual, they believed, Plato taught that the body, that the soul would flee bodiless to the heavens and enjoy bliss. Okay, here's the point. The Greeks and others believed in immortal spirits, but they would never use the word anastasis, resurrection, to describe that. They would use something else. They would use the word pneuma and speak about the spirit or the soul. But they wouldn't use the word for body. And pagans, Jews, and Christians, all of them used the word for body. There's some other issues. These are worse problems. Picture the family of Jesus. They rebury Jesus' bones a year later. Mary, a believer, James, who's now the head of the family, they rebury Jesus' bones. And every time they put a new family member in the tomb, they almost trip over Jesus' ossuaries. These ossuaries were left out. And they would virtually trip over his bones. And his name's right there. This is no secret. Anybody who goes into the Jesus family tomb, if this is his family, they would trip over his ossuary with his bones. And they're going to triumphantly proclaim, I saw the risen Jesus. And mean by that, I saw his body, anastasis, which literally means to stand again. It's a compound word meaning to stand again. What goes down is what comes up. And James was a skeptic until he met the risen Jesus. Virtually every critic out there admits this. Mark 3 says James thought his brother was deranged. Beside himself is the Greek. And James then comes to the Lord because he saw a resurrection appearance of Jesus. That's conceded by virtually everybody. But tell me, on this theory, how does it work? James steps over his brother's ossuary every time he walks into the family tomb. He walks by or over his brother's ossuary, and yet he's going to confidently proclaim that his brother's been raised bodily, and I saw him. And yet here's his bones again, and here's his bones again, and here's his bones again, in blatant contradiction. The theory just does not work on any grounds. And so today, as I said, article this week, people are pulling away from it, and they're saying, oh, okay, maybe it's not the tomb of Jesus. I mean, there's nothing in its favor. There's no arguments. And except for the original two producers. And now I'm told they're issuing caveats. Of course, their book's been out for 3 weeks. The documentary's already been. Nobody knows what's going on, but the Discovery Channel pulled the documentary. No name list, no picketing by Christians. In an article that was published on this, they said, well, we may bring it out again sometime. But it was scheduled for rebroadcast, and they've never shown it, even though it was the most watched film on the Discovery Channel in the last year. It's not been shown again. So let me... Whoa, look at that. I did not even know that was up there. Well, this is neat. Only it's not updated. If you go to GaryHabermas.com, right in the middle of that page, there is a thing you can click on to, and you can find an article with almost all the statistics that I've given here. It's underneath the article file, which is over on the left. But GaryHabermas.com, you can get an article which updates a lot of this, and you can. I also have a number of other websites that you can click on to, and you can get information. So it's hard to do it with a lesson like this because it's so unbiblical, but let's go ahead and close in prayer. Lord, I thank you for your word. I thank you for the time of season this is, and even though we are always answering and giving a reason of the hope within us, Lord, we would be remiss not to mention that just a week ago, we've celebrated the resurrection, the glorious resurrection of your Son, Jesus Christ. And even as Paul said, Jesus will come and change our vile bodies to be like unto his glorious body. Even so, Lord, we've sung about it this morning. Help us to rejoice in the resurrection of Jesus, that critical attempts have disproven this, that we should just take a step back, take a breath, listen to these claims, and most of all, celebrate this great act of our redemption, of which we can be most sure, on which history agrees, and which we can apply to our lives, realizing, as Paul says in the same 1 Corinthians 15, that those who've died in Christ have not died in vain, that we grieve, but not as those without hope. Lord, help us to be sure of the practical implications today in our lives and in others. We pray, Lord, and thank you for the data you've given us, the facts, and this time together in your name. Amen.